Hello and welcome to another episode of Transmission. Today we're joined by Chris Hewitt, who is the Chief Exec of Solar Energy UK. The conversation covers all things solar and increasingly battery storage in UK, ranging from domestic installations all the way up to grid-scale solar projects that are being approved directly by the Secretary of State. We look at how this all stacks up in the government's central planning and how large the solar fleet might be by 2030. I really enjoyed talking through some of the key biodiversity statistics on solar sites, as well as some of the finer details of bringing solar projects to life on domestic homes. If you're a grid-scale solar developer and want to look at the revenue future for solar sites, do get in touch with the Modo Energy team. And with no further ado, let's jump in. Hello, Chris. Welcome to Transmission.
Thanks. Thanks for inviting me. Glad to be here.
And so, starting off in the normal tradition, who are you and what's your role in energy?
So I'm Chief Executive of Solar Energy UK. So my background is actually in energy and climate policy. I've worked in that through my whole career, over like 25, 30 years now. Renewables, green economy. I moved to work for Solar Energy UK in 2017. So basically having spent my career writing a report saying this is how you get a green economy to work, then I started to represent the people who are actually doing it for real. So that's been exciting. I'm glad to do it. So Solar Energy UK represents 430 companies now across the whole sort of solar energy storage space, all the way from sort of the large developers and manufacturers, all the way through the sort of distributors, all the way to the small installers.
Okay. And I think people might have guessed from the name, but what exactly is Solar Energy UK?
So yeah, we're the trade association that represents, as I said, 430 companies, which is in solar and energy storage. Increasingly, if you're in solar, you're in energy storage. They all go hand in hand now.
I agree. So how do you think the solar roadmap, so to get straight into the detail, how do you think the solar roadmap will help the rollout of solar and batteries in the UK?
So the solar roadmap is something which we started work on that with government under the previous government. So we started it in 2023. It's taken until a couple of months ago to publish it, because obviously it had to be revised and updated and improved, actually, I think, with the new government. So it's now got, it's a roadmap which says we're going to deliver up to 57 gigawatts of solar in the UK by 2030, which is ambitious, but we believe as an industry is absolutely achievable. And it sort of breaks down some of the barriers. There's sort of 60-odd actions in there, which some of which are industry-led and some of which are government, about how you address some of the barriers to make that deployment happen.
Okay, and let's help people understand, right? So 57 gigs by 2030, what's the capacity of the solar fleet today?
So we're about, it's probably 20 to 22 gigawatts. I give a range because the market numbers on the commercial sort of the large rooftop are a bit shaky. So we think it's probably a little bit more than government is saying. So say there's about 22 gigawatts of solar. Okay. In the market at the moment, deployed, we think we can effectively sort of 2.5 times that by the end of the decade.
Okay, so 5 years-ish to deploy 30 plus gigs. So you're running at just over 6 gigs a year.
Yeah.
But we've only delivered up until 22 at this point. So does that, is you see where I'm going with this? Is the deployment doable?
Can you really do that? Yeah. Yes, and the reason I'm so confident is one is the rooftop market is growing and it's very robust. It's actually since COVID, it started growing through the COVID through the pandemic in 2020. Since then, it's been on a steady incline of deployment. So this year in the residential market, we're on track to be the largest, the biggest ever deployment of solar in the UK, even under comparing to the highest sort of feed-in tariff days. So that market's very robust. So that's going to continue to grow. See no reason why not. The utility scale market, we probably have almost as much projects as we require to deliver that 2030 target already have planning permission or are receiving planning and going through the system at the moment. So it's the pipeline is absolutely there. It's we just need to sort of get on and build it.
Okay, so the pipeline's there, they've got planning, and typically if you're going through connections reform at the moment, you've probably got land as well. But the thing that I think is probably it's difficult for batteries going through a similar process is just the ability to be able to deploy the gigawatts per year is quite hard because you actually need the sort of electrically qualified people, you need the grids to be able to accept that, and there's some quite limiting parts to that deployment. Is that a similar story from the battery side for the solar side as well?
I think the some of the big themes of the roadmap are one is the network, the grid, the connections, and this I'm sure you've spoken with your other guests around some of the problems and the challenges faced there. That's probably the biggest challenge is getting the connections agreed quickly enough. The second and third ones are supply chain and skills. And that's where we're seeing, yeah, we absolutely need to grow the workforce. We are seeing that workforce grow, and we're starting to see people coming from outside of the sector and come sort of transferable skills. Classic one is ex-military personnel starting to move into the renewable sector, solar and wind. And so I think it's absolutely doable. The one reason I'm really confident we can get to that speed of deployment is because solar and batteries are the fastest to deploy. So if you're building a nuclear power station, you ain't going to build that by 2030. But we know that you can, I mean, solar, residential solar can be done in a day. Obviously, utility scale solar is a bit longer, but it can be done in a matter of a couple of years, 2 or 3 years. So
yeah, and I can vouch for that solar and battery number being a day. Had it installed on a house, on my house very recently, and it really was a day to get it done. It's remarkable. So somebody said to me, we need to think about getting homes to be battery ready. And I thought, I've just had a battery installed in my house, and it took a day. I don't understand what could be done to get them more battery ready. They just plug in.
Yeah, it's a very, compared to lots of other energy technology, it's very, very straightforward. Yeah.
Yeah. That one had me scratching my head a little bit. Okay. And so one of the really interesting things I think we've touched on here is the sort of connections reform change. And so you were saying that there's still some doubt in terms of whether people get those positions in the queue. Is there not lots of certainty coming out connections reform? So once you've kind of got your site and you've got the planning permission, shouldn't you have a locked in date at some point this year confirmed to you?
I think we will do, yes. I think come the end of this year, there will be a lot of certainty for a lot of projects. I think the challenges which NESO are currently underway is to do that queue reform process. So there's two things. One is we had issues around, if you like, what they thought the allocation of solar and batteries should be. Up to 2030, we're broadly happy. Post 2030, I think they're underplaying it. We may come back to that. The current issue is that the connections portal, literally the sort of platform that the IT, which everyone is making their applications on live now, there's developers huddled around tables all over London, frantically trying to get their data into these portals. And it's not, there are glitches, and it's not a bit more than a glitch. There's a lot of problems. And so that is having to be delayed.
Yes.
Because it's, in its current form, not fit for purpose.
Yes.
NESO are putting a lot of resources in to try and fix those problems, and we and other trade associations are working very closely with them to make sure that happens. But that's, so there's a bit of uncertainty about the actual process itself at the moment. But yeah, I'm sure we'll get there by the end of the year. There will be a lot of certainty for some projects, and some projects won't get their Gate 2 offer. So that will mean there will be some which probably do get delayed. So we don't know yet.
And we should also say that today is the 29th of July. This will probably air, I think, towards the end of August. I would say that this will be solved by then. It'll definitely be solved by then. So yeah, fingers crossed. And one thing we did see on the connections reform, perhaps before the sort of glitch came up around the ability to submit projects, there was also some backwards and forwards around the volumes that came out in the first draft. What happened there?
So this goes back to when the new government first came in. They wanted to, they tasked NESO with delivering, some advice on how do you get to zero carbon power by 2030. They gave, to be fair to NESO, they gave them a very short timescale, so they could really only use the data they had in the future energy scenario FES, which we don't think the assumptions for solar and batteries were up to date in that. And so the numbers they first came out with were a little bit shy on where we thought the industry was, could deliver. And that was just based on what we knew in terms of viable projects, both in the planning system, had got planning permission and were about to get planning permission. So we did challenge the government and NESO over that around the time the Clean Power Action Plan came out. And the 2030 numbers were revised to make it more in line with what's happening on the ground rather than the spreadsheet. Unfortunately, the numbers for 2035 were also put into that plan. They haven't been reality checked. They are still off the FES spreadsheet, if you like, and so that's our concern, is that we need to have some sort of reality checking of those numbers, and we're in the process of discussing that with NESO and government.
And for anyone kind of scratching their head and thinking, what on earth's going on? So I just add a little bit of detail. So the future energy scenarios, the FES, they give a direction of where the market is going. And then the connections reform process, which allocates the connections, runs off FES as well as kind of other forms of modelling. And that is the way that people get grid connections. And so if kind of FES has kind of got the wrong number in it, then it can be possible that connections reform doesn't make available.
Yeah, what they're doing is they're giving allocations per technology. So sort of saying, so solar's got a range of 45 to 47 gigawatts, and then another 10 gigawatts of rooftop. So actually in total, it's 57. Wind has got a certain set. CCS has got some, nuclear's got some. Obviously, those are assumptions that are going in. And I think the thing with solar and batteries in particular is they are such fast-moving technologies. Assumptions that even we had as sort of industry leaders 3 years ago have changed. You know, the cost of batteries have dropped dramatically. So actually, it's really hard, I think, for a sort of system modeler to keep up with the speed of change in the solar and battery market.
Yeah, I totally agree. We've had many conversations with the FES team around just how quickly this moves. And I think even in a year, you're seeing sort of totally different battery costs coming in. I think it's then really, really hard to actually be someone who's responsible for modeling that, because this is moving. And so all of your assumptions might then change quite a lot quite quickly. And so that does mean that I think there's perhaps a real sort of humility that's kind of needed in the process to make sure that you're sort of adaptable to if it does change to this, and if it is this easy to install it, and if the supply chain is there, then yeah, let's make the most of it. Let's go quickly and let's sort of take this low hanging fruit that's being offered to us.
Exactly. And I think that's the position solar is now in. Solar is now undoubtedly the cheapest way of generating power in the country. No technology. The last CFD auction prices, solar was the cheapest. And that's, so yes, and it can be deployed very quickly. So definitely we would say take advantage of that. Some technologies are going to be slower to deploy and may also slip. CCS is an unproven technology still in terms of the scale that's required at. We know that nuclear power stations do have a tendency to slip their timescales. If any of those things drop out of the queue, then we know solar and batteries can fill that. And so I think that's what we need. We need that flexibility to keep the investment sort of warm, if you like, so that investors don't say Britain doesn't want solar or batteries anymore, we'll go to Germany or Spain or wherever. But because they should be able to have some comfort from government that there's likely to be more required in the next few years.
Mm. And can we talk about the 2030 to 2035 section? Because the battery forecast was a little bit similar. It was like, this is such a good technology, we want 23 to 27 gigawatts of it definitely by 2030, which is a huge increase from the 5 to 6 gigs we're at today. But after 2030, oh no, we don't need it.
We've got enough now.
And you kind of think, well, that's a bit of a head scratcher. What's going on there?
that baffled us as well. It makes no sense. It makes no sense with current technology, let alone what's going to be like in 5 years' time. I think there is a sort of an inertia in the energy planning system, if you like, and in the way that perhaps sort of NESO thinks institutionally, to think about big power stations, and it sort of wants to bring a big thing online that it can turn up and down. That's traditionally how the system has been managed. That is not how wind, solar, and batteries work. So I think there's probably a lack of confidence, particularly in how important batteries are going to be. And I think they really understand the short-term sort of day-to-day sort of fluctuations, struggling to see how batteries are helpful beyond that. Whereas if you look at countries like California, for example, California has about 10 gigawatts of batteries, I think. Yep. There are times of the day when batteries are the largest deploying technology in California. The sun comes up and it goes down, the batteries switch on, and it's 30% of the power in California, which is the fourth largest economy in the world. So there's other countries which are moving much faster on this. And I don't think we quite realized in Britain how quickly these technologies
just developing. How much and I think it'd be remiss of me to not put some numbers in there. We have a team in California in Texas, so California numbers around 12 gigs. I think they added 2 gigs in H1 of 2025, which is just a crazy number. And I think ERCOT has just gone through 10 gigs as well. So some fun facts on battery deployment and just for the solar angle. So was it a reasonably strong deployment up until 2030 and then a bit of a question mark between 2030 and 2035?
I think the numbers they've got in there sort of slightly tail off in terms of the acceleration of deployment. So it's still growing, but it's not growing as fast as we would expect it to be. Okay. And again, if you look around the world, so the Netherlands now has 20% of its power annually coming from solar. We're at the same latitude as the Netherlands. No reason why we can't reach those sort of levels. Germany has 100 gigawatts of solar deployed already. It is crazy. And of course, Germany is a larger economy, but it's not that much larger. So again, if you look at across other countries, we should be matching that kind of level of deployment.
Mm. And I should say, sorry, when I said that's crazy, I don't mean in a negative sense. I mean that this is just, if you've watched this space for a number of years, like the speed that some of these technologies are now starting to deploy is incredibly interesting. Germany also home to balcony solar.
Yes.
Is that something you've come across at all?
It's something which I know the government's really keen on. We need to look at the I think it's possibly easier in Germany because basic things like you've usually got a socket on the outside of, okay. in a German balcony, I understand, whereas we don't here. And so there'll be some technical issues, I think. But the one thing I think you can say about solar is that it is such a flexible technology that you can deploy it. Yeah, almost a gigawatt scale in the solar farm now. You can deploy on a reservoir. You can deploy on the roof of a car if you want. You can put it all sorts of places. And in 10 years' time, they'll be deploying solar in areas we haven't even thought about because it's such a that modular sort of technology makes it very, very flexible.
I think you also, I know we're kind of going off a little bit of a tangent, but I think Solar Energy also do some work on some of the biodiversity pieces on solar farms as well. Just when you were saying sort of a deployment at say 1 gig scale makes me think of adding on say solar to sort of low quality farming land and that sort of classic picture of sheep beneath solar panels. I think some of your team have worked on that.
Yeah. It's something which we've worked on as industry for the last sort of 3 or 4 years actually. So we now have an annual survey by members of ecological assessments on solar farms, and it is becoming apparent that you get good biodiversity if it's managed well. You get very good biodiversity on solar farms. So if it's replacing arable land, you're not putting pesticides on, you're not putting fertilizers on, you are just leaving the land to rest. It's often sown with wildflowers to give it a head start, so you get a lot of floral diversity, you get more bees, more butterflies, the bird populations follow as well. RSPB have just surveyed 3 areas of land in East Anglia. One set of land where it was a solar farm that was managed for biodiversity. Another area where it's solar farms that were not managed for biodiversity, and the arable areas. 3 times more diversity of birds on the solar farms compared to the arable land. So that's the RSPB's numbers, not ours. So I think it's a growing area. I think solar will also support the nature recovery as well as climate.
I think people are really passionate about this area, and rightly so. And it would have been remiss of us to have not touched on it. Yeah. Okay, let's now talk. We've talked a little bit about batteries and solar, sort of side by side, just as kind of separate technologies. Let's combine them and let's talk about co-location. So, in many cases, co-location seems like a really good thing to do, but sometimes we don't see as much of it as we think we might do. What is kind of the problem in co-location, or is there a problem in co-location?
I think we're starting to see it come through now. So I think of that, it's something like 10 gigawatts of solar has got, 15 gigawatts have got solar or got planning permission already. There's another 10 in the planning system. Amongst those, I think about 6 or 7 gigawatts of those are co-location projects already. So primarily what you see is if you're designing a solar farm, you're likely to have some battery with it now. It's the question is, do you do the batteries first or the solar first, or are you building them all together? So I think it will start to come through. But I think there's probably some complexities in the way that things are regulated and the way the connections are agreed, for example, which is sort of slowing down that process. You still hear stories of a company which is asking for a connection for a 50 megawatt solar farm and a 50 megawatt battery, and the DNO will come back and say, yeah, right, you need 100 megawatts of connection then. Clearly, in the real world, that's never going to be the case. And so there's an education piece, I think, in terms of where the networks are run.
Yeah. So the kind of the basic concept would be that instead of having to sort of double the amount of network capacity, you could just combine the two. The battery works around the solar, and you just get better utilization of your network. I think what was quite interesting, we had the Clean Flexibility Plan came out last week, I think, certainly the second half of July. And within that, it was talking about the potential for co-location to be a way of prioritizing certain forms of grid connection in the future. And I think that for me is very exciting because it's essentially saying, well, look, we don't necessarily need to build brand new substations. We might have some sites where we revise their connection agreement to allow them to be able to do this, which just allows the network to be run slightly hotter rather than having to build out whole new swathes of network.
Agree. I think that's definitely the way forward. And also, I think we need to look at the way existing connections are used. So if there are thermal power stations that are going to only run 5% of the time, is that connection being utilized for the other 95% of the time for renewables? It should be, if it's not. So that I think is something else which we need to look at.
Yeah, super interesting. And I hope that it's kind of forming a key strand of the Strategic Spatial Energy Plan, which is what NESO are working on alongside the additional network plans that kind of go underneath it. I won't go into acronym city, but there are lots of plans that exist. Okay, so let's move on from co-location then to behind the meter. So what is, everything's behind the meter.
So I guess now we're talking about let's move to the sort of the rooftop and the sort of the smaller scale solar. Certainly, anecdotally, what we're hearing for residential solar is that over half of all new residential solar installations, not the new build stuff, because that's driven by regulation, but anything which is retrofitted onto existing homes, 50%, at least 50% is likely to have a battery with it as well now. So there's that market is really taking off. It's also often linked to the fact that someone might be looking at having an EV in the future, or they've got an EV, electrification of heat. So those four technologies of solar, battery, heat pump and EVs are really starting to sort of be merged together in the consumer's mind. So it's going to grow fast, I think. And I think there is potential for behind the meter batteries, particularly to help with some of the system problems we have. So take Scotland. We know we have a lot of wind, which is currently being curtailed because the transmission network can't export that level of power. That should create a strong market for behind-the-meter batteries and time-of-use tariffs in Scotland, because you should be able to get very cheap electricity at certain times of day. And so that's something I think we will start to see more of.
And so I really like the idea of lots of wind in Scotland, very cheap energy bills in Scotland. We have talked potentially too much on this podcast about zonal pricing. So zonal pricing now is not going to be considered an option in the near term. We then have a lots of generation in Scotland, this desire to really get sort of batteries and EVs to work in Scotland to make the most of this sort of excess generation. Have you looked at all about sort of ways in which we could kind of get low-cost energy into consumers' homes?
I think it's less about where the energy is, when the energy is. I think we need a debate needs to now focus. Now we've moved past the zonal pricing debate, which I think everyone got bored of. Even Greg Jackson probably got bored of it in the end. But so now we've moved past that. I think what I'm really more interested in is the time of use tariffs, okay, and how we get that sort of timing, because there will be times when there is, if we treble solar on the grid, there will be times when there's more than 100% of solar on the grid. We've had days when it's 40% already. So there will be times when that drives very low pricing in the wholesale market, which should be a market opportunity for EV charging or for batteries. I'm not sure it needs that much policy. It needs a bit of allowing those sort of markets to develop and encouraging those markets to develop, because I think that's where I see it going in the future.
And I think we've done an injustice. Obviously, you're from a solar background and we gave a wind example. We should have given a southwestern solar example, shouldn't we? Missed opportunity, I'm afraid. Domestic solar feels like a slam dunk of an idea. It doesn't take long to install. If you have a roof, you're lucky enough to have a roof, then you can kind of get it installed very quickly. The panels themselves, £100, £200, not very much. Is it ever a bad idea to get domestic solar?
Very rarely. If you live in the shadow of a tower block or under a very large tree, then yes, that would be a bad idea. But it'd still be a good idea to get battery, because I think that's that sense of how the battery can offer you cheap electricity even on its own if you can't get solar. But generally, 95% of the time, solar is going to be a good idea for you. Yeah, I think what we're encouraging the government to do, and what the government is doing, is there is a strong market in the, if you like, the able to pay market. Those who have got, the one barrier, the biggest barrier, is access to finance. So if you have the access to capital, you can borrow and put it on. Absolutely, you should. Not everyone does. Mm-hmm. So the fact the government is allocating a fair chunk of money to the Warm Homes Funds, which will include solar and battery sort of grants for low-income homes, is a really good thing. I think, again, there's interest in trying to make sure that landlords and the rental market, there's more access to that. GB Energy obviously funding schools and hospitals and care homes and all sorts of places, which will really, really benefit from solar and cut down their running costs. And therefore, so I think you need to use the government money in a wise way to increase the access to solar and batteries to those who don't have the access to it at the moment.
Yeah. And I think I should, just for completeness, a solar panel might cost you £100 or £200, but you still need the company to come along.
The installation is...
The installation cost. So there might be scaffolding, it's kind of fixing to the roof.
It's still a few £1,000. And if you're looking at solar and a battery in a house, then you probably are talking about £10,000 and more, depending on what size of system exactly.
I could give you a number.
From personal experience.
Personal experience, I can tell you that 10 panels, a 6 kilowatt-hour battery, total cost is about £8,000.
There you go.
Whether that's figure.
I'm always reluctant to sort of say it's going to cost you this much, because it absolutely depends on the sort of the aspect of your house, the design, lots of things can change. But it's not an unreasonable sum, but £8,000 is still quite a lot of money to a lot of people. So I think there's, and there's other things we can do. And we are talking to the finance sector. I think if we can get, if you like, the mortgage market to start to value solar and batteries more, I think that's one thing which we did research a few years ago, which demonstrated that a home which had solar on it, like for like, is likely to be £2,000 more valuable than a home that doesn't have solar. Mm-hmm. That was 2019. We did that research. That was before the price of energy went up. So I suspect that that value is a lot greater. It's estate agents still don't necessarily understand, I think, the value of solar and batteries on home. But I think that it will come. It will come.
It feels just like absolute lunacy, really. Like it's something that you don't have to do anything. It runs kind of on your home kind of automatically. It cuts your electricity bill massively. I really do scratch my head when someone says, oh, I'm not sure it's going to add value to your house.
It's kind of like, but like I say, it's this year. We think this year is going to be the biggest deployment of residential solar ever in the UK. So I think it's starting to get through in the market. And it will get to a tipping point when, I think as well, when you start to see those new build housing estates on the outskirts of town, you come in to a town on the train and you're seeing an entire estate with solar on, it'll start to sort of tip in the mind. Yeah. Think, actually, that's what a modern home should have. That's going to be a very low bill. It's going to be a lot less to run than my house is. And so I think that will start to have some sort of behavioural effects.
This might be an insight into my life, not yours. do you find that you sometimes walk around a sort of suburban place and you look and you think, the last time I walked down this road was that solar panel there? Because I find myself thinking that.
You can't help but look at roofs when we're traveling on a train in my job. So yeah, you're looking, oh, should be solar on that. Or your heart is lifted when you do see a very large solar array on a warehouse or something. So,
I'm pleased we've got a shared passion for looking at rooftops. Okay, very good. Okay, let's move on to the solar task force. So it's key to the solar strategy. You have been co-chairing it today. What tangible process have we seen so far?
So I think the solar task force itself was set up as a temporary body, if you like, to draft this roadmap, which we've done. So that was a joint government industry. I co-chaired it with previous Conservative ministers and Ed Miliband latterly. It's now produced a roadmap. Thankfully, that roadmap is not just going to get stuck on a shelf and ignored. There will be a permanent body, the Solar Industry Council, which will also be co-chaired by myself and Michael Shanks, the Energy Minister. And again, we'll have a sort of a set of stakeholders, probably a little bit wider than the Solar Task Force. Hopefully, it'll start to meet in the autumn. The idea is that we'll meet three times a year to sort of check where we're up to with the roadmap, but also be a place where if there are other barriers come up, then we can start to raise those issues with government. So I think it's now sort of hardwired into the government's thinking, which is great, both in terms of targets, but also delivery. And it's a partnership. So there's things which we are going to be doing as an industry, which we've pledged in that roadmap. And so in a sense, the government can hold our feet to the fire as well. So.
Mm-hmm. And what would be an example that a consumer might be able to understand?
So, well, I think it's things like the changes to the future building standards, which will require more solar on homes and warehouses. That's one of the things which is in the roadmap. There's a number of things on skills and supply chain, sort of, and trying to sort of make sure that there's like warm home sort of skills grant. Some of that will go into sort of helping to train sort of solar installers, for example. There's no sort of lots and lots of big issues. There's like 60 small things, but but they all add up. So it's on things like, skills and labour force, trying to make sure there's some UK supply chain benefits in from the industry, both solar and batteries, network sort of connections issues. So it's there's lots of little things, but I think it adds up to something which is substantial.
Okay, and to ask one kind of final question before I go into the sort of usual last two, I wanted to ask about the really large solar projects. Sometimes you see these kind of going through kind of quite protracted planning permission processes. Is there any kind of work that's being done in that space to make sure that is kind of being streamlined?
So I suppose in the last 2 or 3 years, we have started to see more larger transmission connected sort of solar projects coming through, which go through the national planning system, not the local authority. It's approved by the Secretary of State. One thing which the new government did do was start to sign off. There was a growing queue of projects which had gone through the system. They were sat in the Secretary of State's inbox, and the previous government was not signing them off. This government has signed off quite a number of them. It did quite a few in the first week, and it's continued to do so. So that's, since it's taken the brakes off some of those sort of planning requirements. That doesn't necessarily mean they're going to get built next week, because you often have conditions in that planning. So that's one of the sort of the little sort of loops we're now going through. So things like, would you believe the sort of the requirements for archaeological digs on a site before it's built? They could be quite onerous. Up to £1 million can be spent by a developer because the local authority has said, we need to check if there's anything important in that ground before you start building a solar farm. So some of those things, we're working through them now, which is taking longer than we'd hope, but it's still, I think it's faster than it was under the previous government.
Yeah. Really interesting. And the size that you need to get to in order to end up in the Secretary of State's inbox, how big do you need to be?
So that has changed. So it was 50 megawatts. It's now 100 megawatts. I mean, still a lot of solar farms are built in below 100 megawatts and will go through the local planning process. And the vast majority of those projects do get approved by local authorities. So that's still plenty of those, which are distribution connected ones. Anything above 100 megawatts goes to the Secretary of State, and then that's a longer process.
Okay, really interesting. So to move on to our final two questions, is there anything you'd like to plug?
So, yeah, the one thing I think I would like to plug is recent Solar Energy UK report on the economic impacts of solar and batteries. So we've looked at the sort of deployment we think is both what's in the roadmap, but also what we think is possible by 2035, and asked an independent consultant to sort of look at what does that mean in terms of GVA and job creation in the country. So that's something, yeah, go to the Solar Energy UK website. And I think the one thing about the jobs in our sector is they're going to happen in the short term. We will be creating a lot of these jobs in the next 5 years. So that's one I would plug.
And did you mention GVA?
Yes, sorry, gross value added. So how much, basically, what is the solar and battery industry going to be worth for UK PLC in terms of jobs and growth for the economy? And obviously, it's a positive story.
Okay, so check out the report and you'll see that in there.
Indeed.
And then final question, is there a contrarian view you hold to something that you believe that the majority of the market doesn't?
So listen to some of your other guests on this one. I think the contrarian view I probably hold is, I think we as an industry are paying too much attention to the Dunkel Flat. I think this period of time when it does happen, where wind will be low and it's been the winter, and so there'll be low solar. I think there are some analysts who are obsessed by making sure we tackle that problem, and we're potentially investing in some technologies which are very expensive to deal with that problem. I suspect solar, wind, and batteries will chip away at that. I suspect batteries will be able to be longer and longer in terms of their storage duration. And so that problem will not be anywhere near as big as everyone is fearing it's going to be.
Okay. You're absolutely right. People do obsess about it. Indeed. And I think that is a really good contrarian view, because it reminds us of this kind of bigger picture that actually we want to kind of reduce carbon across the system really quickly with the tools we've got now, solar, wind, battery. That's going to move us quickly. Worrying about the Dunkelflauter is a problem that we don't all have to work on.
Indeed.
Chris, thank you very much for coming on Transmission. You've been a fantastic guest. We hope to have you on again soon.
Great. Pleasure.